This podcast is rated S for science and also for spoilers and swearing. There's going to be swearing.
Something is killing these people and sucking them dry.
Run! It's a stampede!
That's impossible. Where are they coming from?
I don't know, sir, but whatever it is, it's, big.
Welcome, everybody, to Cinematic Animalia, your weekly foray into the biology of movie monsters. Today, we are looking at 90s cult classic Deep Alien... We are looking at 90s cult classic Aliens... Deep Rising, right?
Ah, there it is.
Today, we are looking at 90s cult classic Aliens Aliening. We'll go over some news first, tell you a bit about the movie, our thoughts, and then we'll have a look at some underwater beasties, including bobbit worms, penis worms, yes, penis worms.
It's a thing.
Octopuses or octopi.
Or if you want to be correct, we could say octopodes.
Octopodes.
They're all right, technically.
And the history of sea monsters. As always, the show will be broken up into those different segments. We'll have time codes below. So if you are really, really curious about penis worms now, we'll have that marked out in the chat.
Don't worry. We know you are.
Yeah. Perfs. But before we get into that, my name's Sam Perrin. I'm a freshwater/invasive ecologist and climate data analyst based in Trondheim, Norway. I also run the website Ecology for the Masses alongside Adam Harsick, a disease ecologist at the Ben-Gurion University of the Negev. Today's mispronunciation brought to you by the fact that I can't speak properly because my nose is clogged up as fuck. Alongside Adam is the Baroness, Her Ladyship Libby Young, our story specialist and writer at Short Story Soup, and we're not joined by Dave today.
So what happened was Dave was watching this movie and seeing these giant penis worms. He felt very... a little self-conscious about his own size, so he decided to hold up a penis worm next to his penis, and then tragedy ensued, and so now he's in the hospital.
Yeah. Our thoughts and prayers go out.
Thoughts and prayers.
So, do we have any news this week? Oh, I've got news. I just fucking spent 5 hours of my life watching Avatar. Did you know they're making, like, 2 and 3 have already finished filming, pretty much?
They've finished filming the third one? I know they've been planning, like, 6 sequels since 2011. Yeah.
Listen, the only Avatar I care about is The Last Airbender, so...
M. Night Shyamalan's classic?
No,
yeah,
no.
That one.
Yeah, that one.
Totally.
I've got to be honest, like, I watched that film in 2009, I was like, this is amazing, and then I came back to it 5 years later, I was like, this is terrible. But I watched it today, I was pleasantly surprised, I kind of enjoyed it.
AKA Dances with Wolves, AKA Pocahontas.
Fern Gully for me.
Yeah, Fern Gully for sure.
But that world is incredible. There is so much cool stuff going on ecology-wise. I don't know if I got lost in that world to the extent I didn't realize, you know, that it's not a good movie. You know, that and Stephen Lang's biceps, which were just
incredible.
Intimidating.
They're a historian of themselves.
Exactly. Don't get me wrong. Josh Brolin was fantastic as Cable, but Stephen Lang wanted to be Cable so bad, and I wish we would have seen that movie.
And finally, I did one tweet that said, yeah, let's lay some cable. That's what I did. And that became the campaign.
Does anyone have any proper news?
I do. Mine is also tentacle related.
Nice.
Right? So they have discovered, scientists have discovered the Joe Biden squid.
I heard called, about this.
I'm going to mispronounce this. Solipsimopodi Biden, and I don't know how to say it because Biden,
two eyes?
Biden eye.
I love the title of this article that I've just Googled. 328 million year old vampire squid named after president.
Exactly. So it is the oldest known relative of octopodes and vampire squids. A 328 million year old fossil was discovered in Montana's Bear Gulch limestone in, not this year, in 1988. Good year. But it's never been closely studied up until now. So they finally got around to looking at all the box of rocks in the back office and discovered this vampiropod that has 10 arms, which is unlike other vampiropods. And that pushes the fossil record for vampiropods, I love that word, by about some 82 million years.
That's dope.
Nice. Also,
it belongs in the museum.
I want to add this little tidbit on here that I've just scrolled to the end of this article on the vampire squid, and I wish to read this bit out. The Psilocybin is not the first species to be named after a president. A moth and a blind worm-like amphibian that buries its head in the sand were named after Donald Trump.
For the listeners here, it's really refreshing to know that a scientist himself cannot pronounce this goddamn name.
Our weekly dose of bad news, microplastics were found in human blood.
Oh,
not just in our oceans, it's not just in our food, it's not just in our land, it's in our fucking blood.
This is where we need to cue the Aqua I'm a Barbie Girl song.
Yes.
Life in plastic, it's fantastic.
Which I think I've heard in every single country I've ever visited, just spontaneously. Like, we heard it down in by the Red Sea this weekend, and it was very pleasant. Come on, Barbie, let's go party.
This week we're doing Deep Rising. Why hire a financial planner when you can sink all of your money into a cruise ship for a vanity project? Why hit an iceberg when you can hire a band of nuclear-armed soldiers of fortune to rob and blow up your luxury cruise liner to collect insurance money on your bad investment? And why hire a soldier of fortune with ship captain experience when you can hire a washed-up Florida rum smuggler and his ragtag crew that you don't know a thing about to drive your hired hijackers to your luxury cruise liner? And why worry about living through an ancient worm kaiju attacking said cruise liner and dissolving the meat from your very bones when you can still try and pull off the insurance fraud sans all those people you'd hired for in the first place? Meet Simon Canton, a businessman with a business plan.
He is definitely a businessman with a business plan.
He has a GED. That's an American reference, right? Fucking nailed it. Yes.
Yes. Yes, you did. Well done.
All right. Who wants to start with what they liked about this movie?
So I've never seen this movie prior, and I really enjoyed it. I feel like this kind of gives me some justification for liking other shitty B-movies from that era, like Deep Blue Sea, because it's not just nostalgia. It just was a quality, I don't know, humorous monster movie. All the practical effects were either incredible or incredibly hilarious, and I kind of liked that I got both, and I never knew which one I was going to get. Like, the scene in the Ming Cruise room when the creature first attacks is incredible. Like, I don't know how they filmed it, but they've got, like, people falling off fucking two-story terraces and shattering through glass walls and, like, big chandeliers, like, crashing into the side. It looks incredible. And then you have this bloated man that, like, pops up in the water that looks like, I don't know what those toys are called, but the ones you, like, squeeze and the eyes pop out. And, yeah, just overall was amusing. And I really enjoyed some of the quotes in particular by Benny, aka Joey Pantucci. Some of my favorites were, I don't like you. And then he turns to the guy and says, you don't even know me. Then they get in the elevator and it's like this big crash. And then something's clearly going wrong with the elevator, but like the elevator music's going. And the main character goes, what the hell was that? And Joey goes, the girl from Ipanema. It's just dumb humor that I always appreciate.
Yeah.
Benny fucking sells all of those things. I think, much like Libby, I have never seen this before. I have never even heard of this until it was suggested by Dave, maybe?
It was suggested by me.
Thing he would like. Yeah. Oh, by Libby, I guess. Yeah. Weirdo. It's very much that perfect kind of late 90s, they haven't quite figured out special effects, but goddamn it, they're going to make it work type movie. Yeah. And it really worked for me. As bad as the CGI could be at times, because most of it was in like weird dark corridors and it was all wet, it already looked wet and shiny anyway, so it just really made the water effects look better, if anything else. The cast of characters was very surprising. So many different recognizable actors in this. It was just like, you're in this? You're in this? You're in this? Also, last week we were convinced that was not Colin Farrell. And in this movie, you cannot tell me that Australian wasn't actually Colin Farrell with a little bit of prosthetics on. Because he fucking looks just like him, but a bit wider. Even though we know that Colin Farrell was very slim at that time. It was super fun. I really enjoyed this. Interesting monster concept to a point, and just a fun ride.
Yeah, I love this as well. This was a movie that was on TV, like, constantly. Just one of so in Australia, we had three commercial TV channels when I was in my mid-teens. And, you know, they had bought the rights to different films, and they would play those films on maybe, I don't know, a nine-month loop. So this was one of those films that was always on TV. And I saw it so many times as a kid, and this was the first time in, like, 16, 17 years I've watched it. And I don't know. I'm glad to hear that you guys liked it as well, because I don't know. I didn't know if it was a thick veil of nostalgia, but I really enjoyed this. Yeah. And there were some really good death scenes in this. Jimon Honsu getting an axe to the face.
Oh my God. That was brutal.
That was awesome. Yeah.
Jason Fleming's massive, just like a huge panic attack moment where he kills the, you know exactly what's going to happen. He kills one tentacle and another one grabs him immediately. Wes Studi, who gets given a gun that he can mercy kill himself with and then tries to shoot Joey Pantucci only to realize it's the last bullet. Fantastic. So good.
That was perfect.
Girl getting sucked through the toilet.
Yes, my God. Yeah, sorry, there was just one line from Famke Janssen that I really liked, because Joey Pantucci did have the majority of the funny lines in this, but I really enjoyed Famke Janssen's, "I'll break your nose, not that anyone would notice."
Just, why? That was so unnecessary. Just him, like, not so understanding mean. Why do you hate me so much.
Yeah.
I do, especially speaking of elevator scenes, Jason Fleming's character that Libby and I definitely... He's 100% having, like, at least one romance with one of the people on his little mercenary team. Just the amount of emotion and,
like, T-Ray.
And T-Ray, and I think also, I mean, he got really upset about another dude, too, when they were killed. It's just, they're not just friends. There's some love going on there.
He was real upset about T-Ray.
He was.
Yeah, and then he had to see his half-dissolved body get spewed out of a fucking tentacle later on.
That was a different dude, but yeah, that was horrible.
What didn't we like about this movie?
I felt like this movie was very close to being a fantastic movie, but it couldn't land in either camp of either taking itself seriously or embracing the camp. And so it felt me like it was like a little too much of both, so it left me lacking in both genres. And I feel like you can tell that this is a precursor to The Mummy, because he took all the best bits from this movie and then made them, you know, polished up those gems and made them shine in The Mummy.
Was this before The Mummy?
This was the year before The Mummy came out, yeah.
Okay. Okay.
Yeah.
Did you have more?
Nope.
I think for me, it was much... kind of a similar thought, but more applied to the monster. So they start off in the middle of the movie describing preapulids, which are penis worms, a real group of worms, marine worms specifically. And I thought, okay, cool, this is a different kind of monster. But then they just go to the, in my opinion, stereotypical and kind of boring classic, like, oh, it's actually a giant octopus with different, like, teeth and not a beak. It's like, you had a chance here to do something really different and have an interesting monster instead of just a big octopus, which I thought was really boring and kind of took away from the ending of the movie for me.
Fair enough, yeah.
Also, it was almost funny because of how ridiculous this movie was, but like fucking Captain Mustache, his mustache either changed or completely disappeared scene to scene. He has one the first time you see him. He does not have one when they confront Famke Janssen. The next time it's thinner. The next time it's upturned a little bit. It is...
magic
bizarre.
Mustache. Maybe he's one of the tentacles and he's learned camouflage, but he hasn't quite mastered it yet. So the mustache keeps changing.
Just a mimic octopus who hasn't quite gotten hair right.
Exactly. He's actually an alien. I feel like, speaking of mimics, I don't know if this is quite a dislike or kind of an appreciation, but I feel like this movie was just full of the poor person's version of blank. Like, lead character, poor person's Bill Paxton. One of the guys in the mercenary squad, poor person Carl Weathers. Captain of the ship, poor person Charles Dance. Like, it's just the bad copy-paste of all these different actors, one after the other. It's like...
yeah, and we'll get into that in trivia, because there's a reason for that. So I found Cliff Curtis's character insufferable. Like, it was almost like a... guy who'd never seen somebody who likes women before. And was just like,
yes, this is what those guys do.
Yeah, exactly. Like, look, the special effects, I don't mind that they look bad on the octopus because, oh, the Octolus, sorry. Because whatever, but the ship looked fucking terrible and the storm in the background was laughable at times. There was a moment,
I never noticed.
I don't know what it was, but there were a couple of scenes where it was just like, come on, you've put so much money into this octopus. Can't you just make a ship look normal? There was a really good comment from Roger Ebert, which I found really hilarious, where he said, he quoted the fact that the ship can stay level even during a raging tempest, line from the movie. I wonder if those speeches were inserted after the filmmakers realized how phony their special effects look. Because it just doesn't move. The ship is not moving at all with any whale. No. I'm just like, well, it's they're hanging a lampshade on it. I don't know. It was very weird.
To that point, there's a scene where they're in the small boat when they in the beginning where they hit the speedboat and like the big crash happens and they get the hole in the boat. And Treat Williams is in his chair and you can see he's like trying to sell it and he's like shaking, like the boat's moving all around, and the guy, I forget the guy actor's name, the guy standing behind him is just perfectly still. So it's like they didn't really get that scene partner memo.
He was just driving the boat in his enormous captain's chair with like 18 seatbelts. What the fuck was that? Rocking around like a motherfucker. And yeah, like Libby said, he's just so
yeah. It's like, and he's in front of him as well. I know the scene you mean. Like, he can see the guy
holding the chair.
Oh, and last dislike is who cries for Uma Damon here? Like Layla, the quote unquote muscle chick. I mean, she gets. I thought they were going for a fridging, like, you know, Kevin J. O'Connor's character, Tooch, was going to have some character development, but he gets over it real quick.
Nah, like, how long
had you guys been going out for? Exactly. Yeah.
I mean, he at least did bring her up, and like right before he did, Libby turned to me and was like, so. Do you care about her at all? Is there any kind of... Yeah. Oh, okay, you did ask. Okay, good.
He doesn't even look for her. He's just like, is she here? He no. Nope. Okay, fine. Yeah.
Oh, thank God. It's just a dead girl.
Ah! Roger, you came back for me.
Okay.
We're gonna have lots of babies.
No.
So Harrison Ford was originally cast as the lead in this, not Treat Williams. Treat Williams was a treat, but a backup, as well as Claire Forlani as the Trillian, the main lead female actor. And Jim Carrey was poised to take the role of Joey. Once Harrison Ford dropped out and Claire Forlani dropped out as well, and then Jim Carrey slowly backed out after those main actors dropped.
Yeah. The budget was also cut significantly after Harrison Ford dropped out. Because, I mean, you know... And you can see that very clearly in this film. This film is essentially what if Harrison Ford was aboard the Nostromo. Like, what if Han Solo was aboard the Nostromo? He is a very clear Han Solo type. Yeah, so this movie originally had the working title Tentacle... and I maintain that because it's such a shameless Aliens ripoff, they were clearly setting up for tentacles afterwards.
I really don't get the Alien ripoff vibe. And I was, and listeners, I was primed for this because Sam mentioned it to us in the group chat before we watched this. So I was like looking for it, and I just really didn't see it beyond the underwater swim scene, which comes almost shot for shot from Alien Resurrection. Beyond that, I really don't feel like there's too many similarities.
This was the start of Kevin J. O'Connor's work with Stephen Sommers. Kevin J. O'Connor, like we said, Joey Pantucci, he went on to play very similar but potentially more slimy characters. He was Benny in The Mummy, as we said, and he was also Igor in Van Helsing.
Was he?
5 years after. Yeah, he's Igor. Yeah.
So good.
Again, yeah, very, very similar characters all the way through. And apparently he did a lot of improv. Like, Stephen Sommers wrote a lot of different lines for him, and he just threw them out and improvised a lot of it. And Stephen Sommers loved it, apparently. So, yeah.
Yeah, that whole can I develop asthma late in life was yes. completely improvised in the moment.
That was a great bit.
I cannot think of any other film that I've seen him in outside of Stephen Sommers' late 90s, early noughties work.
I was going to say, by the way, you said you were glad that he got a happy ending for once. With what the trivia I read originally, he did get killed off early on, and the test screening. Thank you. Like the test screening crowd, basically made it known that they were unhappy with that decision, so they rewrote it to where he got his happy ending.
Nice.
Yeah.
Yeah.
His girlfriend's still dead, though.
Yes,
exactly. Brutally.
Don't bring her back. Yeah.
Brutally.
So one of the other things that I really liked about this movie was the ending. And so the bit of trivia that I have is that the island that the survivors become stranded on at the end of the film is a nod to King Kong and Skull Island, but it's more than a nod because it was actually intended to be a lead-in to a King Kong reboot, which would have also been directed by Stephen Sommers. In the late 90s, the idea for a modern-day Kong reboot began making its way through Hollywood. It was kind of a response to the rather poorly received Godzilla by TriStar Pictures, which was released the same year. The idea was initially picked up, and Sommers was already attached to the upcoming Mummy reboot. And so he wanted to be involved in the project, but the reboot wound up in, quote-unquote, development hell, and eventually was passed on to other studios, becoming the basis for the 2005 remake by Peter Jackson.
Cool.
5 degrees of separation from yeah. Deep Rising to Peter Jackson.
Frank Welker, who people might know from so much stuff. He was in Gremlins, he was in Troll, he was Scooby-Doo.
860 roles is how many he's been known for.
He was the voice of the Octolus. I say voice with a quote unquote around it, because what does that mean? Like, he was the Anaconda in Anaconda. He was Pegasus in Hercules. Like, what is he doing? Is he just a really talented mimic? Like, is he the mimic octopus of Hollywood? What's going on here? If anybody knows what it means when it says that Frank Welker voiced Reptile in the Mortal Kombat movie or the aliens in Independence Day, please let us know what that means, because I am so, so curious.
You find that most guys who do voices in the cartoons can do many impressions of people and sounds and all that, but other cartoon characters I do
Baby Kermit on the Muppet Babies.
And Skeeter, don't forget Skeeter. Now, she's a little girl, and he never mentions her because he's a male chauvinist frog.
Yeah, I guess I am a male chauvinist frog.
So, before we get stuck into the science today, if you've got any thoughts or questions, you can find Adam and I on Twitter. I'm at Big Dr. Fishboy. Adam is at Hassick Adam. If you want to get in touch with the podcast, you can visit our website, cinematicaanimalia.com, or email us at cinematica.animalia@gmail.com. You can also chat or game with us on Discord. You can find the channel link in the episode description or on our website. If you want to read Libby's work, you can visit shortstorysoup.substack.com for a corpulent banquet of short stories. And if you want to hear more about some of the less movie-related ecology that Adam and I write about on a very... on a regular basis, alongside an enormous and happily expanding team of writers, you can check out ecologyforthemasses.com. By the way, I just want to say a quick shout out to everybody who helped spread the news that we are looking for more writers on Ecology for the Masses at the moment. It's been a bit difficult keeping it running lately with, you know, both of us doing full-time jobs and us publishing 3 articles a week, which we've somehow managed to maintain for 4 years. We've had a great response over the last week. We've had, I think, about 7 or 8 people get in touch and say they'd really like to write, including some people who had way more experience with science communication than we did when we started the website. So, yeah, thanks again to everybody for helping get word out there and telling your friends that that we're looking for writers. Because, yeah, and thanks to everybody who's helped us keep the blog running for the last 4 years. So, yeah.
And thank you, Sam, for the enormous amount of work you do for the blog.
Mm-hmm.
You're welcome. Okay, so before we get started with the science, we talked about this extensively in the Aquaman episode a couple of years back, but it's been a while since then, so we should probably just mention up top that anything that exists, like, really, really fucking deep down in the ocean is going to be really well adapted to the insane pressure that creatures undergo down there. Now, of course, there can be creatures down there. As Eva Paulus pointed out when we did that interview with her for Underwater last year, it's more weird that we're able to exist up here, right? Because life, you know, life evolved in the oceans initially. So of course there's creatures down there that can maintain that pressure, that can maintain living at that pressure. But the problem is when they come up to the surface, of course, that pressure disappears. And they, what's the word?
Decompress.
Yeah, so when creatures come up, they experience that pressure differential and they decompress, like Adam said. The most well-known example, I guess, would be the blobfish, which we've talked about before. So everybody knows the blobfish is this hideous, weird creature. It only looks like that when it's been brought out of water because it's experienced that depressurization that we're talking about. Normally, it looks like a perfectly normal fish. Yeah. But when you bring it out of that high pressure that it's used to, it turns into this sloppy blobby mess.
It looks like Jimmy Durante. I always called it the Jimmy Durante fish.
It does if I can, yes.
Not a good looking fish, but also not a not a very alive fish when it looks like that, because it's, you know, gone through a horrible amount of pain and stress.
Not at all. One of the most horrifying things I've ever heard of as far as industrial accidents is the explosive decompression that happened to 8 divers, I think, on a deep oil rig. Basically just exploding from the change in pressure, and it's horrifying.
The second paradox about this that we have spoken about before, I think we talked about it, A, with Aquaman and B, with Underwater, is that if there is a lot, like from 1 kilometer down to 2 kilometers down out of the water, it's fairly high pressure, but you have a lot of food down there. Like there's massive amounts of fish that spend a lot of the time down there during the daytime before migrating up to eat at nighttime. Huge amount of food source, but that's reasonably accessible to humans. So if there was an enormous species down there that was feeding on those plentiful food sources, we would know about it.
Potentially. It took forever to find the giant squid. It was like mythical until 20 years ago.
Yeah, but we're 20 years hence. Oh, I guess this film was 22 years ago. So yeah, we may not have explored that part of the ocean, but I still feel we would have found it before, or as with the giant squid, found evidence of it before. True. Adam, you've told that story about the fact that we knew giant squids were out there beforehand because we found whale carcasses with marks on them, right?
Whale carcasses and or live sperm whales, because sperm whales are especially adapted to hunt and eat giant squid, and they have to dive to incredible depths and incredible pressure for a very long time. But by looking at the sucker marks on the outside of these sperm whales, they're like, wait a second, there's a squid out there that is e-fucking enormous.
There is an area of the ocean that could potentially be just outside of our range where there's enough food, but I maintain that to be this unknown to humanity, it would have had to be much, much further down. I think they offhand make some sort of a remark about 30 to 40,000 feet, which is about, what's that, 10 kilometers down?
10 to 12,000, yeah, 10 to 12 kilometers.
Yeah, so I mean, that's too far down for a species, A, to be able to find enough food to get by, and B, for it to be able to survive when it comes up to the top. So about halfway through the film, Simon Canton makes the somewhat wild claim that this is the Archaea Otoya. I'm beginning to fear that our friends here may be some kind of strange offshoot of the Archaea Otoya family. At 4,000 feet, the Otoya are only as long as a pencil, with bodies about the size of a golf ball, but at 20,000 feet, those have been known to eat full-grown sharks. Now, the Otoya are a real thing. However, they have not existed on this planet for about 500 million years.
They were a real thing.
They were around during the Cambrian. So if people haven't heard of the Cambrian explosion, it's this point in the history of Earth where all of a sudden, life got real funky real quick. Most evidence suggests that before the Cambrian period, which is about 600 million years ago, there was very slow evolution of different organisms. But after the Cambrian explosion, there was suddenly this intense burst of life under the water, and we got heaps of different organisms, which kind of laid the basis for a lot of the phylum we see today. Phylum being a really high taxonomic group. So chordates or vertebrates are a phylum.
Chordates are a phyla.
Yeah, so everything with a backbone gets lumped into one phylum. These were burrowing worms, and they have modern-day what are thought to be relatives that are called penis worms.
Preapulids.
Yeah, the preapulids or penis worms. Now, these worms, they're ancient, like I said,
look like penises. Sorry.
They do. They look like penises, yeah. They're a group of worms that were found at the Burgess Shale. The Burgess Shale is an area in British Columbia which is famous for having really well soft-bodied organisms that have been amazingly well preserved. Because normally, soft-bodied organisms do not get preserved well in the fossil record because they're soft-bodied. And they don't tend to fossilize well. But the Burgess Shale is an area in British Columbia where we have tons of these things. It was one of the first areas where the Cambrian explosion was really touched upon because of all the fossils they found at the Burgess Shale. So these were most likely, like I said, there's a lot of inference because all you have is a fossil. You don't have anything about their lifestyles. But compared to their relatives today, the penis worms, these were most likely predatory worms, and they were capable of everting their pharynxes or their esophaguses to produce these teeth-like spines, which they may have used to grab prey. They may have just used to drag them through the mud.
Yeah, a lot of this taxonomy and linking related species or related groups of organisms to one another is based off of morphological characteristics like this. And in the case of penis worms or preapulids, this eversible pharynx, usually with teeth on it, is a very distinctive characteristic of that group of worms. And since these guys had it, they were probably a relative.
Yeah. So they also had kind of anchors at the other end of their body, which would have probably anchored them into the sediment. And it's likely that they would have been ambush predators. So they would have popped out and grabbed prey as it was swimming past, which is a really common tactic for worms that live under the sea. But there would have been some really cool predation techniques, some of which we probably saw here. The digestion of one of the characters, I think, was it T-Ray that was digested?
It wasn't T-Ray, it was the dude Billy. Who was left on the boat.
Billy.
Oh, Billy. Right, yeah. Billy. Yeah, the one who gets spewed out onto the deck. That kind of external digestion is very possible. Or internal digestion in this case. I'll get into some rampant, like, wild speculation as to how this creature actually works later.
I have thoughts.
Yeah, they could have been spraying mucus on things to slow them down. If they were actually mobile, if these things were mobile, so maybe they were spraying mucus on things to slow them down. We do see some mucus erupting, but I'm not sure if that's like...
It's from the bullets.
Digestive juices and that sort of thing. But yeah, spraying mucus is a very kind of common tactic for a lot of these underwater creatures and above water creatures as well. Velvet worms spray this kind of...
I was going to say velvet worms.
Yeah, they will spray like just this gooey weird shit all over an insect to slow it down so they can, you know, come up on it as slowly as they like because, yeah, worms don't tend to move very fast. Or they could be, yeah, more ambush-based predators. I like the combination of the two. I like seeing mucus get sprayed everywhere, but it's not really what we get in this one.
I heard that about you.
But the jaws on this thing do remind me a lot more of bobbit worms. So the penis worms have, I don't know, I don't want to say pretty basic, but they're not that interesting when it comes to the actual jaws they use to catch things.
Not as complex as other organisms.
Yeah, bobbit worm jaws, though, I guess maxillae is the correct term, but let's say jaws. So they are horrifying. They're essentially these two massive kind of hooks that spread out from each other as a result of the creature being able to evert, kind of spit out its pharynx. And they will wait until something swimming above them triggers their antennae, and then they will jump out and snatch these things down, drag them back into the sand. Because the creature moves around, the sand kind of collapses in on top of them, trapping them in there. And then the bobbit worms will inject them with a toxin and slowly digest them. So that's what I think would have been more likely here, because I think we've talked about this before. Nobody wants to eat something while it's going down your throat as it's struggling. Pelicans do it on a regular basis, but most creatures don't like that sort of thing. So I think injecting them with a toxin would have made a lot more sense here.
To that point, there are some pretty horrifying images of birds that usually do this swallowing it whole and alive strategy, with said prey erupting from its body like an alien because it found a way to chew its way out, which is horrifying. There's like either an egret or a crane of some kind flying with a snake sticking out of its throat at the base of its neck because it ate its way out. There was a pelican with its entire bill thing like missing and bloody and shredded because it tried to eat a turtle, I think it was, and that did really not go well for the pelican.
No.
Yeah.
So yeah, eating something alive is not the best idea.
Have you guys seen that video of the pelican trying to put its mouth around a capybara?
Like four different capybaras?
Yeah,
he's calculating.
Whoop. Nope.
And of course, the capybara, the most zen animal in the world, is like, I don't care, I am zen.
But our bobbit worms, so we often only see the tips, but they can be up to three meters in length. Not quite as large as the ones we're seeing here. And a lot thinner, normally only 2 to 3 centimeters wide as well. So I like the idea that these are some sort of platyhelminth that has just managed to grow enormous. But of course, you still have the pressure differential stuff. But I think that's really cool. Like Adam said, I think that it's a much neater creature if they're individual worms or ambush predators, rather than the kind of what I felt was a bit of a cop-out of the one giant creature.
I think it's more terrifying, too, because if they're all tentacles attached to this octopus, then they can't go everywhere. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah,
it's always attached to a base. So it eventually will have a max stretch length. It'll have like a place it can't reach, that kind of thing. But if they're individual organisms like the worms you know, several of them, that's horrifying. You can't get away.
Yeah. That is a little weird, like, when you go back and think of that later. Because if they're individual organisms, yeah, absolutely they can get anywhere. But if it's one giant organism, how is it feeling its way across, like, 9 levels of cruise ship?
Yep.
Yeah.
I have 2 theories about this. The first one is, this is an organism that has evolved the ability to partially or completely digest prey items with its tentacles, which would come in handy because octopi, octopodes, octopuses, they're all technically correct. They are very talented at squeezing through very small cracks. The only thing they can't get through is their beak because it is a hard substance. Everything else, even their brain, is very squishy and bendable and pliable. So being able to, if a prey item can escape you, or at least escape your beak, and you can't drag it out of a crack, but you can instead just swallow it inside of the crack with your arm and then let your arm do the digesting and then pull your arm back out once it's all done, that is an incredibly useful skill to have. It makes absolutely no sense when you have a massive toothed mouth attached to the main part of your body. But that's one possibility of this, an octopus-type organism that has tentacles that are kilometers long, apparently, but also short at the same time, with the ability to not only have an actual mouth attached to its body on its face, like a human, not underneath and between its arms and tentacles, like all cephalopods do.
Yeah.
Or we're seeing two different types of organisms here. We see, and which is going to make a lot more sense because we have the worms chasing these people all throughout the ship, swallowing them whole, digesting them, spitting out, partially digesting, I would say. There's a lot of meat left on these skeletal remains, including eyeballs, which are not digested at all, which should be the first thing to go, even though it is the first thing to go at the climax of the movie. They're on the ship doing this. In the very end, we just see this much larger predator attracted to all the carnage, the noise, the blood, and the commotion, like a lot of predators are. And this makes a lot more sense when they come to the charnel house that is the central meeting area of the boat, and there's all of these skeletal remains and blood and everything. And if this is where the worms like pounced on that central group of people that we see at the beginning of the movie, it makes a lot of sense that all those bodies would be there because these worms would eat them, and they'd be very sluggish and have trouble moving because they're full of prey that are struggling and or digesting. They spit out the remains and they go off looking for more prey. But if this was that massive octopus thing, it would just swallow them whole. There's nothing left. With the teeth that are half the size of the people it's eating, you can't pick away the bones around a human body and leave that mess that was left in the main part of the boat. So I think these are definitely some kind of octopus-type creature that, for whatever reason, has evolved a mouth on the front of its head and not underneath. And then some of these worms, there's some cross between these preoculids, the penis worms, and polychaetes, the jawed worms, which is what the bobbit worm is part of.
Yeah, I think that makes a lot of sense, yeah.
Don't pee in the water.
Why?
A candida, a vicious parasite, will swim up the urine into your bowel. It'll swim up your ding-dong, and once it gets in, you can't get it out.
Well, then what?
They have to amputate.
Let's talk about octopuses in that case, because you were mentioning before the fact that they can get into anywhere that's larger than their beak, which is totally true, which is why, you know, it makes total sense that a creature that huge could just, you know, get inside a cruise vessel quite easily.
Yeah.
The example that's given in the movie of the octopus, you know, getting into the jar, so totally legit in that case. I mean, as long as the jar's opening is larger than the beak, not a problem at all. And the other really cool thing about octopuses is that our intelligence is distributed centrally. We have a cranium, which is where our brain is.
Heard of it.
Keeping you updated on the hot science, if you didn't know that one already.
Wow.
But octopuses have their ganglia and nervous systems and, well, what we would think of as a brain, distributed along their arms, which gives individual arms a lot more autonomy than our arms have. Everything we do is guided by, you know, that one brain in the middle of our heads. But octopuses, yeah, they have a lot of autonomy along the different arms. They can act individually. Individual suckers can even act individually. So one of the things about this, though, is that if they are, you know, arms of the larger creature, I don't think they'd be, you know, ambush predators. I think they would be constantly blindly groping around. I think that the most realistic death scene was that woman who got sucked down the toilet because the octopus has just, you know, happened to come up through the pipes and found a woman sitting on the toilet and just, you know, yanked her down. Potentially, I mean, you know, some suckers on octopi can pick up chemical signals through their legs or through their arms or through their suckers. So potentially they could be following those kind of trails that I'd imagine the humans are giving off some sort of chemical signals that are leaking into the water. Or perhaps they're just, you know, sensing disturbances and going after them. So, yeah, but that is really interesting, the whole concept of all the creatures seemingly acting autonomously but being part of one central creature. Because, yeah, that's kind of how octopuses work. But obviously, yeah, this is not an octopus. This is an octolus.
Almost yeah, his dumb name everything. Is the fucking Argonautica.
Argonautica.
We're gonna have a Greek themed name on a Chinese Southeast Asian themed decorated boat with Polynesian or Hawaiian dancers. What is happening with this shit?
I mean, no wonder it was a money pit.
The example they give of the fish in a jar with sealed with a cork is a good one because octopi can do that. But it's even more impressive because you can take a jar and seal it shut, like twist the top on like a mason jar, and the octopus will unscrew it, get in there, eat whatever you wanted, get back out, and close the lid if it wanted to.
Yeah, they're such smart animals, and they've become a really good model organism for studying intelligence. Because their intelligence is so different from ours. So mice are often used for intelligence studies because their brains are actually really similar to human brains. Octopi are used as model organisms because they're so different from us, which is really cool.
I studied a bit about the penis worm because I was very curious, and I saw that cannibalism is very common in penis worms. So is it safe to say that penis worms also like to eat a dick?
Yes, I think that would be fair to say, yeah.
Yes, and if the movie's any indication, they like to swallow. I will replace that joke that's definitely going to get cut with a little science factoid. I can't speak for octopodes, but squids, at least, part of their brain, part of their nervous system, wraps around their esophagus. So if they eat too large of a meal, trying to swallow that will give them brain damage.
Cute. Your sister's boss gave me a microscope that would have made me retarded. Oh boy, Rick. I don't think you're allowed to say that word, you know? Morty, I'm not disparaging the differently abled. I'm stating the fact that if I had used this microscope, it would have made me mentally retarded.
Okay, yeah, but I don't think it's about logic, Rick. I think the word has just become a symbolic issue for powerful groups that feel like they're doing the right thing.
Well, that's retarded.
Yeah, my last bit of blind conjecture was that I don't think it would make sense for this species to have individual mouths on its tentacles. I think those would more likely be kind of storage pouches so it can drag the food back to the central repository, I guess you'd call this mouth. And I don't know, I think tentacles that long might make sense in a really, really deep environment because the food is so sparsely scattered that you want to be able to explore a really large area. But and Dave would probably be able to back me up on this, but I think the energetic cost of having such sensitive, capable limbs would probably outweigh the benefits it would convey.
I would think so.
Yeah. But I think it's like a, it'd be a really good storage space if, like, at the end of your tentacles, you've got like a kind of pouch where you can inject someone with a toxin and then, you know, retract the tentacle back to the mouthful region. Mouthful region. Fucking hell.
Oh, oral cavity.
Please take over. Yes, oral cavity.
So I wanted to talk about sea monsters in literature today. Quick shout out to Julia, the Gothic librarian, for some really fascinating information. But sea monsters are present in some of the earliest written works of recorded literature, which is awesome. There's a Babylonian creation epic dating back to the Bronze Age, which is about 3300 BC to 1200 BC, for those of you not familiar with the Bronze Age dates, as I was not. But the Enuma Elish is an epic that tells the story of the sea monster Tiamat, who is a Babylonian goddess of the sea who is said to represent primordial chaos. Sometimes she is depicted as a beautiful woman, but she is also portrayed as a monstrous serpent or dragon. And in the epic, Tiamat is slain by the storm god Marduk, not Marmaduke, Marduk, and her body is used to create the heavens and earth. So no, Tiamat is not just a D&D goddess, but a much, much older creation.
A badass five-headed dragon goddess.
Exactly. The Hebrew Bible, obviously, contains a sea monster called the Leviathan. I may have heard that one before. But it is also said to have been influenced by the Enuma Elish. So the book of Isaiah describes how God will kill this Leviathan creature at the end of days, much as Marduk killed Tiamat. Now I just want to call him Marmaduke. The Norse Vikings obviously told a tale about Jormungandr, for any of those who have played God of War or read the great book by Neil Gaiman called Norse Mythology, or just familiar with Norse mythology in general. But Jormungandr is the world serpent who encircles Midgard. He's one of Loki's children and was tossed out into the great sea surrounding the human realm by his kooky grandpappy Odin. During Ragnarok, it's prophesied that Thor will ultimately kill his nephew, the world serpent, before dropping dead from its poison. References to Jormungandr can be found in the Prose Edda and the Poetic Edda, both 13th century works of Old Norse literature. So then going forward in history, you have the Greeks via the Odyssey by Homer, 8th century BCE here. The Odyssey, if you need a quick 8th grade refresher course, is a Greek epic poem passed down from oral tradition and is one of the oldest existing works of Western literature. Odysseus, the protagonist, tries to get home constantly, but he keeps running into problem after problem and monster after monster, including a number of different marine monsters. There are sirens, who sing an enchanting song that lures sailors to crash their ships onto the rocks. Odysseus commands his crew to plug their ears with wax.
It's basically the most elaborate excuse for why are you home so late ever constructed.
Exactly.
How 10, 15 years too late?
I think it was more than that.
You could just say you were seeing somebody else, Odysseus.
Seeing many people.
Yeah. Well, he was, right? I mean, he was seeing Circe for like 3 years.
So he also runs into two different sea monsters at once, passing through a narrow strip of water that goes between these different monsters. One of them is called Charybdis, a mysterious monster responsible for creating huge whirlpools, and Scylla, the six-headed creature who snatches up Odysseus's crewmen with each of its heads.
Can I just jump in here and say that the PhD project I actually worked on was called the Odysseus Project, because it looked at the Scylla was the fact that dams are ruining ecosystems everywhere for freshwater species, but Charybdis was the fact that if you knock those dams down, it lets in a bunch of invasive species. So, yeah.
Cool. So going forward in history again, in 1830, so jumping a little bit, 1830, we have Lord Alfred Tennyson's poem called The Kraken, which describes a slumbering beast called the Kraken, shocker, and its eventual rise to the surface of the sea, resulting in inevitable death. The creature actually probably originated from the spotting of a gigantic squid that was first identified in A History of Norway in 1752. And it's also said to be a biblical reference influenced by the Leviathan in Milton's Paradise Lost, full circle again to the Bible.
Libby, you've said before that a lot of the shit that, you know, is part of a pop culture these days wasn't really that well known until Victorian England took it and was just like, this shit is cool.
Oh, Victorian England was the biggest group of bored people ever and just romanticized the fuck out of literature. Basically, any concept that you have about the medieval times doesn't come from medieval times. It comes from Victoria literature. So this whole like knights and chivalry and all that stuff. No, they made all of that up.
Horns on Norwegian Viking helmets? Not a thing at all.
Yep. 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea, 1870. This is an important sci-fi novel by French author Jules Verne. And this book is what truly popularized the image of the many-tentacled sea monster. The plot begins with the marine biologist Pierre Anorex chasing after rumors of this mysterious giant sea monster. He joins a crew to hunt the beast and obviously runs into a huge futuristic submarine commanded by Captain Nemo. The submarine is attacked by a pod of giant squid. In which they fight them off, but one of the crew members sadly doesn't make it. And then from there, you get the more modern classic sea monsters like H.P. Lovecraft's Call of Cthulhu, Peter Benchley's Jaws, and just beyond. So that's kind of where all the inspiration from sea monsters came from in literature.
Yeah. And speaking of many tentacled monsters, what was Nemo's ship called?
Nautilus?
Mm-hmm. I just always like that name.
Yeah, the Nautilus is a family of mollusks with real... Yeah, cephalopods, actually. So, yeah, same class as octopus and squids and that sort of thing. Yeah,
this monster had no class.
Coming full circle, there is a genus of octopodes, actually, called Argonauta. So, Argonautica, I guess, would mean small octopus? Should throw in at this point that when he says the Argonautica at the start, I had no idea what he was saying. It's just like, my ship, the Argonauta! Argonauta! He said it twice.
His entire speech was nonsensical.
Oh, yeah.
I laughed. It came out of his mouth so clunky. I'm like, why would you ever name your ship that?
Something that you can't enunciate properly.
Exactly.
We're like us calling this podcast Slipsum Benai Denai.
You two are so good at this.
So I just lifted the entire island out of the ocean and I was about to throw it in outer space.
Stop talking! It's my turn now.
Well, it is about time. Wait, is that your new stage voice?
Yeah. What about it?
Well, I mean, are you like gargling marbles or something? I could barely understand it.
Do we feel bad for this monster at all?
I don't.
Yeah, good.
It fucked around and found out.
I mean, it's not like they disturbed it. Like, it kind of came looking for them.
Yeah. You fucked around with a Harrison Ford type?
Exactly. Yeah. I would say it was a pretty good move until Treat Williams got there. It pretty much ate everybody.
I like the idea of it, like, swimming around under these things. Is it Harrison Ford? Isn't Harrison Ford? No, it's Treat Williams? Okay. Oh, well, good. I'll attack now. Yeah.
Normally, I feel bad for these monsters that are just like animals doing their thing and eating people like predators do, but there was not nearly enough character given to this monster for me to care anything about it. So I don't really feel anything for it.
How about, let's sympathetic twist. This was the 90s before we understood. We understood a fair bit about overfishing, but maybe the area that it's in has been overfished to a certain extent and it's very stressed and needs to find alternative food sources.
Or it is
a dick.
Acoustic pollution is a huge issue in nature, but also in the oceans and lakes and rivers. Because if you've ever been underwater when a boat goes by, it's really fucking loud. And your ears aren't adapted to hear underwater. For other organisms like fish and everything else that lives in the water, that's a really painful and stressful thing. So it has come to associate that noise with loss of prey and a stressful situation. So it says, hey, fuck your boat. Oh, and you're not moving anymore? Perfect. I'm going to come smash you.
Yeah. If you want to see an amazing visualization of what noise pollution can do in the oceans, there is an amazing visual that somebody created. I apologize to that scientist because I cannot think of the name off the top of my head. that visualized all the world's major shipping routes and just showed the dispersal patterns of one individual whale over the year and just how it would bounce back and forth in this kind of cage that has been created by the world's main shipping routes. It's really, really sad.
Heartbreaking.
Yeah. Would we recommend this movie?
Yeah. It's super fun.
100%.
Yeah. It's, don't go into it thinking it'll be a Harrison Ford film, but, yes, I would recommend it.
He even says, I have a bad feeling about this at one point. Like, it was so obviously written for Harrison Ford, yeah.
That's absolutely perfect. Yeah. So next week, we're going to be dipping our toes back into the world of video games for the worldwide sensation that is Elden Ring, a game from Software, the studio that brought you Dark Souls and Bloodborne and Sekiro, The Shadows Die Twice.
Never heard of it.
Yeah, I'm sure. So strap in if you're a gamer, give it a try if you haven't yet. I can't, spoiler alert, I can't recommend it enough.
And I will be joining for a video game episode finally.
Yay!
Maybe, yes. If I'm not dead.
You're not allowed to be dead, because if you die, you just get respawned at your site of grace.
Oh, video okay. Games. Is that how it works? Okay. Why are we worried about COVID then? You come back with COVID.
Elden Ring next week. The monsters aren't real, but the science is.
They answered a distress call.
Where the hell is everybody?
Now.
What the hell was that?
They're dead in the water.
I got a really bad feeling about this.
The ship's infested! Let's get the hell out of here!